Welcome, everyone, to another episode of the Perceptive Podcast here on Game Wisdom. I am Josh Beiser, and we got a great cast for you tonight. My guest is the owner and founder of Misfits Attic, who previously made the game A Virus Named Tom, which was an action puzzler title. And they are currently working on a very interesting Dirty Tech-style roguelike, which I've been streaming and posting a lot of videos on, which is Duskers. Please welcome to the podcast, Tim Keenan.
Hey, Josh.
Hey, Tim. It's a pleasure to have you on tonight.
Thanks for having me.
Yeah, definitely. I've been enjoying Duskers a lot over the last few weeks. I posted a lot about it. I think it was either you or someone from Misfits X was actually watching me stream at one point, which was really fun.
That was probably me. And it's actually kind of funny to hear your voice. Because I'm used to hearing it, like, on the video, and so now to be talking to you is kind of weird. I feel like I'm watching YouTube or something like that.
Awesome.
I've got, like, a tab open somewhere with, like, one of your Let's Plays playing, and I've got to stop it or something.
Cool. And it's funny, the Let's Plays are a second part of Game Wisdom. The podcast came first, so it's weird talking to you the other way around this time. But I'm sure we're going to have a great cast regardless. And one of these days, I should definitely have you on the stream. We can talk about Duskers and play it live in front of people.
Yeah, that's always fun. Definitely. It's hard. It's easier when you're... I find even for me, it's hard when I'm streaming and I'm playing the game as much as I've played it before. Because you're trying to talk through what you're doing and then things start going wrong and your brain's kind of half there.
Oh yeah, I've had that happen a lot on these streams. I've been doing some more streaming with developers lately, and it definitely causes some cross wires a few times. And especially during the stream when you were on, all of a sudden I'm talking, then all kinds of crazy stuff starts happening on the screen. Like, oh crap, I'm trying to talk to you, talk to the viewer, and then talk about what's going on. And just everything went to hell.
We have a button over here. Since it's connected to Steam and stuff like that, we just hit a button and it just causes everything to go horribly wrong in the game. I think it's funny. Yeah. We built that in specifically to troll people.
Awesome. All right. But to get the ball rolling, Tim, since this is your first time on the cast, for people who haven't heard of Misfits Act before, could you tell us a little bit about yourself and your background in the game industry?
Yeah, sure. When I got out of college, I started a studio called Rainbow Studios, which was, we were making like AAA games like ATV Off-Road Fury and Splashdown and stuff like that. I quickly burnt out because the game industry is kind of brutal.
Yeah.
And I moved into animated features. So I started working at DreamWorks Animation, worked on Shrek 2 and How to Train Your Dragon and Madagascar and all those kind of fun things. And then at some point, I just really wanted to go back into the game industry, but I didn't want to go back into the game industry and repeat what my experience was. So I decided if I was going to go be brutalized, I might as well be working on my own things. And that was close to the advent of, you know, XNA and a lot of these new tools that made it a lot easier to be a sort of garage band indie developer.
Yeah, definitely.
So that's when I started that. I conned my wife into not only letting me quit my job, but into her making the art for my first title while she continued to work and had my child. I was definitely father of the year in 2011. And then we put out A Virus Named Tom. And that was I think, critically very well received. It did decently. Like, it's really hard to speak of successes because there's like different levels of success. Yeah. There's an indie success, which I view as, given that there are so many indie developers and it's so difficult, there's no way that I could possibly say that A Virus Named Tom was not an indie success. However, when you have a mortgage in the Bay Area and you have a kid and, you know, all of these things in your nice adult life that cost money, it's really hard to go from a salary at DreamWorks Animation to, you know, an indie developer. So from that standpoint, it was definitely rocky. But we made it through and we were in a Humble Bundle and we got the deal with Sony to put it out on Vita, which is still on the way. And then we started working on our prototypes for our next game, Duskers. We were fortunate enough for Duskers to get indie funded. which basically means that a bunch of indie devs, actually it was one of the first times that they went outside, not one of the first times, I guess, but on the beginning of that cusp of going outside those core seven people, you know, bringing in people like Tommy Refiniz and, mm-hmm. you know, Sarah Colin Northway and Cliff Harris and all those guys, Jeff and John mm-hmm. over at Humble, like a bunch of other investors that kind of got together and gave me the money to allow me to make the game. Now, you know, it's not charity, of course, they're investing. Yeah. So, you know, if the game makes a lot of money, then hopefully they make some money. But it's still definitely a risk. And it's something that I feel that a lot of them did. Mm-hmm. I feel like a lot of them do that to help encourage a diversity of games. And Duskers is certainly a strange game. So mm-hmm. It was one of those. Yeah, I mean, that was kind of amazing. Then we launched on Early Access about a month ago, I guess. Yeah, about a month ago. And the reception, I was really nervous going into that because the game is really quirky and weird. And I didn't know how people were going to perceive it. And we didn't really have a lot of run-up. Mm-hmm. On A Virus Named Tom, I had more time to do the marketing thing because I kind of got the game kind of got delayed for various reasons. And so I was able to do more marketing. Mm-hmm. But for Duskers, we hadn't really launched a trailer or anything like that. And then a few weeks before, we finally put out like a little teaser. And then we started like, you know, trying in earnest to make people know the name of the game, which still a ton of people don't. But the launch, the early access launch went incredibly well. And, you know, we're like 97% positive on Steam. We've got an amazing community that's given us awesome feedback. People get the game, and that felt awesome.
Yeah, definitely. When I got the message from my contact, Eric, who I also know from Arkane Games, he mm-hmm. gave me the copy of Duskers, and I played it. It was like, yeah, this is definitely a different game, especially different when you look at A Virus Named Tom. It's just a completely different genre, yeah. completely different style of game. And
yeah.
One thing that I find very interesting, you mentioned Cliff Harris from Positech. At this time of this recording, I actually literally just spoke to him about 2 hours ago. That's who I was doing a live stream with.
Oh, really?
We were talking about Gratuitous Space Battles 2 and just chatting up there. So it's very funny that we had that.
Yeah, he's great. Yeah. I mean, he's actually been very involved, like, as far as he's been around for so long, and he's done some amazing things, and he's very good at not completely depending on one thing or another, because he's weathered, you know, the yeah. storm, if you will. And so he's been really good about trying to help me out with, you know, thinking outside of my little indie bubble brain about, you know, how to market the game, or, you know, how to maybe make it so that we're, you know, selling it off our site so that we're not completely dependent on, like, you know, either be it Steam or Good Old Games or whatever. And so, so just that's an added benefit when somebody not only helps you fund your game, but then you can kind of through that pick their brain on all these really cool things. Not that he doesn't post a lot of great blog posts, and he has an open ear to almost anyone in the indie community, but I feel a little less guilty when I email him a question.
Yeah, talking to Cliff is definitely great. We spoke a few weeks ago on the podcast, and one of the topics we talked about was how he's taking more of a publisher role with a lot of newer indie developers and just helping people out. As you said, Tim, he's been in the industry for a while. He's found a way to stabilize himself as an indie company, which I think is one of the hardest things to do right now for the indie community. We're seeing a lot of indie developers struggle, I think, to maintain their studio. They can make one game, but then whether or not they survive is currently up in the air. A few minutes ago, you brought up the great point of defining what is a success in the indie market, and that's something that's very tricky, especially for a lot of developers from like 1-2 man teams to smaller studios. As you said, a game can sell well, but if it doesn't make back the money that you put into it or doesn't help pay the bills, it's like, you know, you still just threw money away.
Right. And we're in a tough spot, being the fact that, you know, we moved here because of my job at DreamWorks, and so we're in a very expensive area. But it's a great area to be in. Like, I sit here, and Double Fine allows me to work out of their office space right now. It's like, there's so many great connections that you can make, and and so many great developers that are here. But I'm always like, we're all crazy. What are we doing in this city? It's so expensive. But defining success is a really interesting thing, because I always say that when you're sitting, I feel like when you're sitting in a room full of indie developers, like let's say you're at GDC or something like that, right? I always feel that no matter who you are, there's someone to your left that's doing worse, and there's someone to your right that's doing better, right? So I could sit there and say, well, like, you know, with A Virus Named Tom, we didn't make enough money to then make a second title, which is a really hard thing to do, right? Like, I'm going to make up so much money that it pays for the first game and then another game. But that's the goal, right? The goal is to make it so that you can keep making games. And then someone to my left, you know, will sit there and be like, I didn't even get on Steam. Like, and so it's like, then you feel like a total jerk to that person. And then the person on your right is just like, oh, you didn't even make enough for like another game. Like, how much did you make? Oh God, that's not a lot. You know, it's like,
I made enough for like 10 games. I can, you know, we were number one on Steam for a week.
Yeah. And it's just like any kind of entertainment. Yeah. It's a very kind of sort of, it's not completely, but there are sort of, it is somewhat hit driven. And so like you have, and we talk about this a lot as independent developers, like you sit there and you read all the stories of all these great successes, and that's, you know, those like,
those are like the dream.
I don't know, let's say 10 anecdotes or whatever, what you envision. And yeah, that is the dream. And then for those, there's like 10,000 like never heard ofs that, you know, either didn't make it to completion on the game, didn't get it onto a service, got it onto a service, didn't even, you know, make a dent, you know, all the way up to, you know.
Yeah.
So there's like all these striations, and it's really interesting because I find sometimes that you just based on the conversation that I'm in, you know, I'll either feel guilty, you know, that I'm doing so well, or I'll feel like I'm just doing horribly and like I shouldn't even be claiming that I'm doing, you know, well or not. And so it's like, and then there's with my family, it's totally different, because when I sit here with Holly, who, you know, is very pragmatic, and not only that, but is helping, you know, to sustain us. And, you know, we have these discussions, and those are a lot harder hitting, because I can't sit there and, you know, look at the mortgage or look at this other thing and say, hey, you know what? They're like, we're doing incredibly well considering that we're an indie on our second game or whatever, right? So it's, yeah, it's really tough.
I know. Going back to what we were talking about with Cliff a few minutes ago, when I spoke with him about him taking on the role or taking more of a publisher view of things when he's helping new developers out, he talked a lot about that and how a whole lot really has to go right for your game to succeed in this market. As you were just saying, there could be 10 stories of developers hitting it big, making millions of dollars, succeeding. And then there's 10,000 stories of developers who either never finished the game, or they finished it and it just did not do enough for them, and they had to close or restructure. And there you go.
I'm sorry, that was on my end.
That's all right. And when we were talking, Cliff and I, it is very challenging. And I think another part of that is a lot of developers who get into this industry, especially indie developers, either don't know or don't want to do the marketing and the PR side. And that, I think, is becoming more and more crucial. As you were saying a few minutes ago with Duskers and A Virus Named Tom, getting like the word out can be very difficult. You said that you launched Duskers with very little fanfare. And one of the things that I see is a lot of developers are basically putting their hope that the game is so good that people are going to pick it up and basically do all the PR for them, you know, with YouTubers, streamers, etc. But in today's market, with so many games coming out, you really can't gamble the future of your company on that. You need to have someone manage the PR, or it's really just not going to get done. Now, there are, of course, exceptions to this rule. There are mega games or mega indie games that are so good or so unique that, you know, everyone's going to pick it up and spread the word. But again, as we're saying, that's one out of 10 stories. You can't just gamble your whole studio just on that one point.
Yeah, I mean, I think you'd be hard-pressed to find an indie success that it was completely based on word of mouth and that they didn't do any marketing. Because even when it seems, I mean, this was the classic thing when I was in, you know, Hollywood. It's like, you know, the overnight success You know, that's how the press always loves to say it. It's like, oh, hey, here's this screenwriter that's, you know, working, you know, they're working at Starbucks or whatever. And like overnight, like their screenplay, and they make it sound like it's the first screenplay they wrote. And usually this is someone who's working at Starbucks because they're a screenwriter. And they've had 10 screenplays, and like some of them got picked up but then never made, and you know, or whatever. And then this one finally hit, and it makes it sound like, because it's really sexy to hear that story of like this overnight success. And most of the time, that's nowhere near true, right? So, but then at the same point in time, like marketing and PR is just incredibly fuzzy. It's just so fuzzy. Now, there are companies out there. Certainly. There are like, you know, like mobile publishers, I'm sure, that like they're making microtransaction games where they're putting out ads and they're getting their ROI and their user acquisition, and they can track those numbers and all that stuff. But like when you're an indie dev, not only do you not have those resources, but everything's just so floaty, because it's like you hear from one person one thing and you hear from another person another. And you know, like I, like for example, like with the launch of Duskers, like if you ask me to quantify, and people have, like other indie devs have approached me and been like, hey, like, how'd you do that? You know? And I'm like, I have no idea. Like, I would love to say that, oh, well, the game is like people are responding to the game. I would also love to say, oh, like, you know, in the weeks beforehand, we did a lot of work trying to get the word out to some press and YouTubers and whatever. Or I'd love to say that, like, we made this trailer and that resonated with people or whatever. But I honestly can't draw the lines that connect things. You know, was it the fact that we had a, you know, previous game under our belt and we had a community from that and a mailing list? Was it the, you know, what was it like? And I'm realizing how hard that is to quantify, and that's why I think a lot of indie devs talk about that, is because it's so fuzzy.
Exactly. We've had numerous discussions on the podcast on this very topic, and I think the thing that I've learned, especially talking to developers like you, and even people who do their own publishing, is that just like with getting into the game industry, there is no real exact science. You can't, there's no checklist that you can go down that's going to guarantee your game's going to be a top 10 bestseller on Steam. There's nothing you can do to say that this game is going to be an amazing product. The only thing I think you can really do is do enough things right to just hedge your bet. And unfortunately, I know it's going to sound very blunt, but you really, you know, cross your fingers and hope at the end of the day. But
yeah, that's definitely true. I think my new philosophy is, so I used to really take a lot of the, you know, these things to heart and really try hard. And this is going to sound probably horrible, but I find that like it's just like anything in life. Like when you put 100% effort into something, I feel, and it's hard to say because I put so much effort into the games and so much effort into everything I do. So this is coming from like a type A personality, you know? So when I say this, you know, it's got to be taken with a grain of salt. But I find that sometimes it's almost like you just need to have a plan that you believe in, and then you just do that plan, right? It's like, because there's a thousand ways to go. And one of the beautiful things about it is that, like, you can sit there. And one of the things I love about Cliff is that how contrarian he is to, like, present-day thinking. Like, I'll sit there, you know, on an email thread, and, you know, someone will say A, and Cliff will come in and say exactly opposite. And that, I've sat there, I remember with Early Access when they were talking, I was sitting there at Steam Dev Days and they were talking about pricing. And they had three different people that did pricing three different ways and they worked for them, you know, like, and you're sitting there and you're just like,
yeah, like, what am I supposed to learn from that?
Yeah. And so like at the end of the day, like you can just kind of spin in circles. And I mean, you try, you know, you try and glean what you do. But I think what you've got to do is what's right for your game. Because more than anything, I think, like, and maybe this is from the guys over at Wolfire, so David Rosen, and then Jeff and John, who then spun off from Wolfire and made Humble Bundle. Their philosophy was always just like, to just try things and not be worried about failing and just iterate, right? And I think what they kind of showed me was is that you can do kind of things that seem crazy. I mean, if you had told me, it seems so silly now, but if you had told me, oh yeah, no, hey, put your game, put it together with a bunch of other games and, you know, people can pay whatever they want, and that'll be a good thing.
Oh, you know? Yeah, I mean...
You could never have convinced me of that, and they just did that, right? So it's kind of one of those things. It's like when we launched Duskers, like Holly and I were looking at each other, and it was just kind of like, actually, you know what I would say is that I think once we made the decision to put a command line interface in Duskers, we were free.
Yeah.
Like, we were absolutely free. Once I made that decision, which I thought was possibly the stupidest, like marketing and whatever conversion and whatever you want to call it, just a really poor business decision. At that point, I was kind of on borrowed time, and I felt like IndieFund had given me this Ferrari, and I was just driving it straight toward a brick wall. And I was like, well, at this point,
yeah,
it's like if I slam on the brakes right now, I'm not gonna be less dead when I hit that wall. So hey, might as well do whatever I want.
Right? It reminds me of that famous quote from Mel Brooks, who said like something along the lines of, "Once you ring that bell, you just gotta ring that bell. You can't stop and bell once it's been rung. Just ring the hell out of it."
Right. And so at that point, I feel like we were free to do, even though like I still put on the brakes every now and then because this is a business and I'm trying to make another game and I'm trying to make this sustainable enough that my wife doesn't murder me. But it's, that was so freeing. Like once we did that, every decision thereafter, it was like, well, we're just betraying the game if we do it another way. And even up to like marketing decisions, like we were going to launch the game at $20. And then we were of course going to do a launch discount. And then we were like, hey, let's not do a launch discount. Like, let's not. Let's launch an indie game at $20 with no launch discount, early access. Right. And we kind of felt like, well, we charged everybody who bought it off the website $20. And the game is in early access and it's going to be there for a little bit. So even if we didn't get everyone and their mom in, you know, trying to play the game, that might be a good thing. Right. We might not want to tempt people to buy a game that they're not comfortable with, especially at this early estate. And I can't A/B test that. I can't go back and be like, oh, whoa, we totally should have done 15 or we totally should have done 25% off because it did way better. So I have no idea, but the game did well. And I feel that our forums are the way that they are right now. Like our forums are amazing. And I think that's because everybody who's in those forums wants to be there, right? Like they are. And I think that has a lot to do with why the game is 97% positive right now. It's because, you know, we're not sitting there and saying like, hey, you know what? Oh, I wasn't going to buy the game, but now it's 75% off. So I'll try it. And I learned that. I think I learned that lesson from the Humble Bundle. Like when we were in the Humble Bundle on A Virus Named Tom, we had all blue thumbs, not all blue thumbs, but we had like a lot of blue thumbs. Right. And then as soon as we got in the Humble Bundle, it turned all into red thumbs. And I think the reason why is because there's, you know, 10 games in that bundle and a million people get it, right? I think something like a quarter of a million people like redeem the A Virus Named Tom key. And those aren't self-selected people. Those are like, hey, you know, I want to play. Like they probably bought the bundle for Fez or FTL. And they're like, I like roguelikes. Like this game isn't a roguelike. Yeah. Thumbs down.
Oh, yeah. I mean, we could spend like the next hour or two talking about game pricing, especially with the Humble Bundle. I was going to say this a few minutes ago, but I'm in the same position as you. When I first heard about this whole bundle thing, like I spend a penny and I get all these games, or I can spend a dollar and I'm like, what the hell is this? And then again, I grew up when games were $70-$80, you know, there was no sales. Yeah. We didn't have a thing like the summer sale. Again, I'm going to sound incredibly old on these podcasts, but yeah, I remember a time where there was no such thing as game sales. And video game pricing is another thing that there's definitely this whole mystique to how do you properly price an indie game. And as you were just saying with Duskers with $20, I think for me, like $15, $20, I think is a fair price for a competent indie game. But one of the debates that we're seeing, probably too big to go into in this very podcast, but one thing I've asked a lot of people is, do you think that we'll see indie developers go higher? Do you think we'll ever see a $40 indie? I know with Prison Architect, it was originally priced, I think, at like $35, $40, and it's going to go down when it's eventually released, which I think is now really soon. But they're more the exception, not the norm. And I think it's going to be really interesting to see what happens with game pricing over the next I want to say 5 years, like for the rest of this decade.
Yeah, I think it's really interesting. I mean, I think for a long time there was sort of this race to the bottom mentality. Just because, yeah, things were getting cheaper and cheaper, and then people, you'd see it on your forums all the time, you know, it'd be like, I put a virus named Tom on discount during a sale, and or even when, you know, a month after launch, or maybe 3 months after launch, we did like a sale, you know, and it was something ridiculous, like where it was either 25 or 50% off, and someone's like, really, like, I don't really bother with anything less than 75% off, and you're sitting there, and I know this is like one out of many, you know, but it's just this brazen, and you're always going to get those, but I think what you need to recognize is that I think people are willing to pay for a solid experience. I think, sure, there's a large group of gamers out there that either financially can't afford to or just don't want to pay a more premium price for games, and that's fine. But I think what we do is because we see the numbers of those people, we forget about all the gamers that are like, hey, you know what? If you give me something like that are if you give me something that I want because I love games and I love this genre or whatever, then you can do that. And that's what sort of Cliff was doing. Cliff was making games like take Democracy.
Oh, yeah.
Right? Like Democracy 3. Like there's a game that like I can't find like 20 of those.
Definitely. We talked about that after our live stream earlier today. I go, I need you on because I need you to help me explain how this game works because I don't know.
Right. But the thing is that if that's your thing, and I showed it to Holly's dad because I figured, you know, he's somewhat political and he got a real kick out of it. And then I bought it for him. Right. And at that point, like, he's not worried about a $20 price, but I don't even know exactly what Democracy 3 is at, but it's somewhere around there. It's somewhere in $20, $25. He's not worried about that.
Oh,
right.
Yeah, definitely.
But if that was an incredibly popular genre and there were 30 of them, you know, then you might have to start worrying about that. And that's what I'm kind of enjoying at the moment with this whole like niche title. I think that Duskers is more niche and it's connecting with people. And so that connection is stronger and those people are more willing to pay for that. And they're also more willing to be a part of that community and not just
buy
you know,
for like just, 5 cents and, you know, spend 10 minutes on it basically.
Right. And then, you know, post an obscenity on the forum or something. So it's like, you know, and so this is, I'm kind of enjoying that. I mean, I know that I'm in a little bubble right now. I'm in a honeymoon phase, which you're always at sort of with the beginning of your games when your community is smaller. But I'm really, I don't know, I'm really enjoying this. And the scary thing about making a niche game is this going to connect with anybody? Or is this like, did I just make a game for like me?
Oh.
And like the guy down the street,
definitely.
You know?
That's one of the things I heard and I thought about a lot, especially as we talk about with how the market has changed. I think you made a really good point about the fact that Duskers is able to succeed because of its niche factor. As you said, there's not 30 other games like Duskers on the market right now. And that's one of the things we also see from the grand strategy and like 4X genre. Games like Paradox Software, I think a lot of the games price at like $40, $50 retail. And they can get away with that because who else is making these games? They're considered like the top of the genre. So their fans know that when they buy one of these games, they're basically going to commit to the long haul because they're not going to get the same experience from someone else for like $5, $6.
Exactly. And that's the hope, right? Is that, and you fulfill that. Mm-hmm. I mean, I would also say that making a procedurally generated game makes life a little bit easier because when people start to give that like value per hour argument, you can kind of keep pace with that. But even then, even still, like I really do feel like you could make a 5-hour game that was incredible and that you will, no matter what, hear from people that it was only 5 hours. But a majority of people, they will pay if the game experience is that great, right? I honestly think that some games being short helps. Like, you could probably argue that Portal was a little short. I'm trying to remember how long that – it didn't take, like, forever
like
to beat.
3 to 5 hours? Well, give or take, depending upon the person's skill. But,
right. But that was such a novel and interesting game that I would – and I never understood that argument. I never got it because I was like, I would rather pay, you know, $20 and play a great game for like 3 hours than pay $5 and play a crappy game for, you know, 50, right?
Oh, yeah, and I think for me personally, I've definitely gone the more quality over quantity route myself. I mean, I like to replay games, like, every so often. I have a list of games like Killer 7 for Nintendo GameCube. That game is only, like, 6-7 hours long, but, like, usually, like, once every 2 years, I'll go back and replay it because it was such a unique and interesting game. And
right. And then that's our prerogative, right? Like, because, I mean, it could be that other people are like, you know what? I don't have a large disposable income. Like, I'm, as we would say, I am time rich and money poor. And so that's totally fine for them too. And I think that's what I'm, the more, maybe it's because I'm getting older. Maybe it's because I'm getting just more jaded, or maybe I'm getting more hippy dippy being in the indie scene for too long. But basically I'm at a point where I'm like, there are so many gamers out there, right? Like, I'm not trying to appeal to everyone. I am trying to appeal to people who would love what I love. So literally, I had a Ask Me Anything on Reddit around when we launched on Early Access. And I don't think they didn't intend anything wrong by this. But one of the questions was, hey, I've only like watched the video and like read the first paragraph description, like, and I know nothing else about your game. So now, like, convince me to buy your game. Right. Yeah. And this is like your elevator pitch kind of moment. And I was like, to be completely frank, I do not want to convince you to buy my game. Mm-hmm. Like, if let's say I do a good job, right? I do a great job and I convince you to buy my game. And by doing a great job is because you didn't like want this kind of game. And then you give me a crappy, you know, Steam review. You're unhappy. I'm unhappy. Mm-hmm. Right. I would much rather, you know, you buy this game because you want this game, you know, and that's why I'm actually really a big fan now of Valve's return policy. Because, and now I get it that like if your game is like a 1 or 2 hour experience, that's really rough on you. But being a game that it's not, like if somebody's returning my game within the first hour or two, that's fine. Like I would rather do that. And I didn't realize this. I don't really. I'm not the greatest business person, but you can actually see on the when people return the game, if they write in a description, you can read that as the developer. And they do that because it might be like, oh, you know, criticism that you can look at and be like, oh, wow, it's not working on this video card or whatever. And a lot of those were really polite. They were really nice. And now, again, I'm in this honeymoon phase. We haven't sold a million copies. But, you know, some of them like, hey, you know what? This seems like a really great game. And I'm really like, I hope the developers do really well. I just don't really like strategy games. So I saw this game and I thought it was a different kind of game. And it's not. But like, this seems really cool. And if I was into strategy games, and if you're not into strategy games, I'm completely fine with you getting your money back for Deskers, because it is absolutely a strategy game. And so like, I'm reading all these and I'm like, man, I'm so glad that like these aren't either bad reviews or people like angry on my forums or whatever. Like, it's just like, hey, you know what? You tried it. Like, it wasn't what you thought it was. So you returned it, and that's fine. You know? And I mean, I don't want to make money off of people that I'm fooling, because that's not like a sustainable business. Not. Well, I mean, maybe in some aspects or something like that. It's not the business I want to run.
And again, the people are, I mean, they're not saying they hate your game. They're saying it's a good game, but it's not for them. And that goes back to what we were saying a few minutes ago regarding that niche success. Making a game that's popular, it's very hard to make a game that's going to appeal to everybody. It's probably impossible in most cases. Or you make something super, super derivative or otherwise like that. But going for like these niche successes affords you a lot stronger of a fan base. As you said, your Steam forums, everyone seems to be generally happy. You're not getting, you know, this game sucks, I hate the developer, this is the worst game I've ever played type messages. Because, as you said, the people want to be there. They want to play this game. And, again, you're not tricking anyone. You're not forcing them. You're not saying, you know, oh, this is a first-person shooter, you know, gory game. And I think your example with the subreddit saying that you don't want to sell the person on the game because if they don't want it, they're not going to really enjoy it. And it's really good marketing. And again, it all goes back to creating a company that's sustainable, you really need to hit from all angles. You need to make a good game. You have to do good PR, and you have to do, you know, you have to be right by your fans. If you burn the bridge with your fans, you're never going to get those people back. It's something that we're seeing with Kickstarter, but I don't want to talk about Kickstarter because that'll be, we'll go 2 hours easily with that. The last example I want to talk about before we talk more about Duskers, another friend of mine, developer Chris Park from Arkane Games, I've had him on the podcast a lot, and we've talked about the challenges of being a indie business, basically running a company. And when you're doing that, you have to approach your games, you have to approach your team a lot differently than if you were just working at a major studio, if you were just a small team. And I think that's another one of those real sink or swim moments, is that you don't... Oh, let me just think about that for 1 second. Okay. It's a real sink or swim moment because a lot of developers don't get into this industry thinking about it from a business standpoint. They think about things from pure art and design, and while that is certainly appreciated, if you don't have that knowledge or the ability to run a company, you may never even be able to put out a game, or you may never put out a game that's going to earn you enough to keep going on.
Yeah, it's a huge balancing act, because then on the other side of things, like, there's a large temptation also to sit there and look at, you know, the market and what the market will take, and, you know, like, maybe find some, you know, way to generate money. But then at some point, it's like, did I get in this to start a small business, or did I get in this to express myself creatively? And there's not a right or wrong answer. Some people I know got into this and really, at the end of the day, they really love the idea of running a company. They love the idea of creating things, but more so, like, you know, employing some cool people and having that atmosphere. And then other people are on the other end of the spectrum where they're just like, I just want to create art, you know, and it's really hard to have your cake and eat it too.
Yeah.
So, and then there's also this kind of fallacy, I believe, that is, like, a lot of my family or friends will be like, why don't you just go make, like, some, you know, derivative match 3 game that, like, will make you a lot of money, right? Because it's just like,
I mean, you look guys, at, like, the Candy Crush saga, I mean,
right, so there's two sides to that story that are kind of incongruous with just sort of reality. Like, one is the, you know, is the artsy-fartsy one, which is, like, I can make money. Like, I made money before, right? Like, I can make money doing things other than, you know, completely, you know, making some, not to, you know, I actually really like Match 3 games, but, you know, it's like, I don't want to sit there and exploit people's tendencies and all that stuff. Like, I could just, like, I was making animated movies before and I was making a decent living. Like, life wasn't bad. This wasn't, like, my only option. And then number two, like, what makes you think that that's a guarantee of success either?
Yeah, we all have our...
Like, all of a sudden, I'm just going to be like, oh, I'm selling out, and then I'm going to make a lot of money? Like, you don't think that there are a lot of people trying to do that?
Yeah.
Right? You don't think that, like, Candy Crush isn't the same example that Braid might be, where it's like, you know, you have these kind of anecdotes that people all base, like, their game plan off of? So I always said, and I remember when I was talking to Holly at first, she was like, why don't we start a company that we think could definitely succeed and make money. And then if we can do that and succeed, then we can, you know, use that money to do what we love. And my argument to that was, is that while I do believe that independent game development is possibly one of the worst ideas as far as, like, we're going to make money, I don't think that any other road is any guarantee either. So if I'm going to spend, like, 2 or 3 years trying to make something, and then at the end of it, it could just fail, I might as well have been doing something
exactly. Oh, yeah. I agree with you completely on that. And again, to wrap up this part of our discussion, it all goes back to balancing the businessman with the artist. And a lot of people can't do that or don't want to do that. As you said, there are people who work on either extreme. And it does take a good mix of the two in order to be successful. And,
you have to be a little crazy. Like, I always say that, like, half of my brain is a director and the other half is a producer. and they just battle with each other all the time. Like, I'll come up with a design idea, and then I'll, like, poo-poo it because it's going to take too long. And then I'll argue with myself that, like, it'll make the game better, and that'll make it sell, so there. And then I'll be like, well, if we don't get the game done, it's not going to sell anything. And it's like, he's a split personality.
Oh, yeah, I think you and I are going to get along just fine on that one. Oh, yeah. Yeah, definitely a great discussion, Tim. And I can feel that if we don't move on, we could just sit here and talk for, like, the next hour and a half, 2 hours.
Yeah. If there's something that I can do is talk about independent video games.
Oh, yeah.
I mean, I can kind of talk about almost anything, but you get me going on.
Oh, yeah. As I mentioned with Chris Park, we had, I think, like a 3-hour discussion or a 2.5-hour discussion. We just couldn't stop talking. We just had so many great topics. And those are the podcasts that I love. But on the other hand, they must be a nightmare for someone to go, I got to listen to a 3-hour podcast. Or editing that. So I do my best to rein things in, but whenever we get on these good topics, it's just so hard not to. But let's move on. I know I don't want to keep you busy all day long. As you said, you have a wife. I don't want her to have any more excuse to kill you, as you said. But
appreciate it.
Let's move on to our big topic, and that is, of course, talking about Duskers. As we've talked about in little bits over the last 40 or so minutes, it's definitely a unique game. It doesn't fit within really a mold of anything that's out there, which is really good. As we've said, from that niche standpoint or that being, it's not a face in a sea of a crowd type expression. I probably just butchered that. But as we've sort of hinted at about the game being about strategy and roguelike design, for the people who haven't heard of the game yet or haven't seen my streams of it, what is Duskers about?
There's a couple different ways to approach that question, I suppose. The top level simple explanation of what Duskers... So Duskers is about sort of isolation and about adapting and things like that. Like, it's interesting because normally when people ask, they say, what is Duskers? And then I say, you pilot drones into derelict ships to try to piece together why the universe is a giant graveyard and, you know, and it's stuff like that. But when you say, what is it about? That's an interesting extra word there. And I think that the game is about isolation. It's about, you know, this gritty feeling of old tech that where technology aids you, but also gets in your way. And it's about adapting to survive. It's got very strong through lines. Those are the strongest thing I think about designing the game was, is that those concepts kind of came into being early on and they just drive everything in the game. And so whenever I have to make a design decision, it becomes very easy because I'm like, you know, is this about adapting? A quick example of that, and I'm already on a tangent, is that a lot of people, originally I was thinking kind of like FTL where, you know, you do a run and then you unlock a new ship type, right? However, and while that in a meta way is adapting, it's not adapting through the play. So I decided rather than do that, I was like, okay, what I'm going to do is make it so that when you're exploring the derelict, you can commandeer that derelict and now you have a new derelict ship. And at the moment, the only real difference is that you have a different number of upgrade slots. So I hope to, you know, flush that out more. But again, that was just something where the decision was made for me because the game is entirely about adapting. And so, like, I wanted to come up with a solution for that where you had to adapt.
Yeah, and that, and basing everything off that adapting and letting your design flow from that, that reminds me of a really good topic I've had with other developers, including Ernest Adams, when we talked about what makes a good game. And one of the things that we sort of all agreed on is that great games, essentially all the elements harmonize with each other. Everything feels like it fits within that design. There's nothing that seems like it would belong in another game or conflicts with what you have. And with Duskers, as you said, everything flows from this objective or this means of surviving and adapting in this universe. So it really gives you a lot of leeway in terms of growing and branching out the game, because you can always fall back on, does this relate to my core vision or the core gameplay mechanic of the game?
Yeah, and what's actually kind of amazing is that the game is like taking on a life of its own because, like I was mentioning, our forums are kind of amazing and the fans are great, and they're actually even starting to quote like things like, "Oh, well, this isn't very Duskers," you know? And what's funny is that they're calling me on those things in the design of my
Nice.
own game. And so a quick example of that is that also in the game, there's rarely a time where one would say that dexterity, like lack of dexterity, lost you the game. Now, if you put yourself in a bad situation, then that's absolutely true. If you open up a door and you don't know what's behind there, yes, like at that point, it might be the dexterity could have saved the drone, but you're probably going to lose a bunch of them, right? However, there was never a point in the game, and I don't want to spoil things, but there are points in the game where something might chew on a door because it hears you and it's coming after you. But it's not going to break down that door in 3 seconds. You're going to have a minute, right? And all I'm doing at that point is I'm saying, hey, like I'm forcing you to do a decision. Like, do you abandon this room? Do you somehow deal with that threat? Do you leave the derelict entirely, never to come back? Do you redock on the other side of it? And now you've got like, sort of an area, a whole area that's dangerous. These are kind of the decisions. So one of the things that they like, for example, there's radiation that floods into rooms, and it happens fairly instantly. Now, what I felt like was that it was just poking you with a stick, saying you've got to make a decision because it only injures you a little bit at the beginning. But for people, if you're damaging them one or you're damaging them 100 HP per turn, like I'm getting hurt, I'm getting out of here. And so they feel like that sort of isn't in line with the vision of the game, which is generally that there might be real-time elements, but none of those are sort of immediate. And I agree with that. And so we're adjusting the game to make it to be more in line with that. Hey, there's not going to be anything random that happens. And there are other things in the game that happen, rather suddenly. And even though that can be fun, like I do agree that like strategically it's even more tense if I give you like, 15, 30, 60, 120 seconds and say, hey, this is happening. Like adjust. Because it's not necessarily that you can easily deal with these things because that occurrence might come while something else is going on. And so you've got to deal with these multiple things. But I think the idea is that, yeah, like if you have these very strong through lines in the game, they become apparent. And then even your fan base will sit there and say, hey, you know what, this is out of line, because hopefully they can kind of see those streams, those currents of what the game is.
And really good point about having to adapt to the changes in the game. One of the things that I saw was the event that the doors no longer close. And so I thought, does he mean every door doesn't close? I mean, can't mean that. Let me just open the this dock here and flush his enemy. I go, open up, wait a minute, the doors are not closing. Oh, and all of a sudden the rage is just pouring out like, oh crap. It just like came in, just flooded the entire ship. And again, as you were just saying, with like having these like the poke the stick elements, like I knew it was going to happen. And I tried to test it out, and I apparently made things a whole lot worse for me because of
What's funny is that that was actually a
it.
bug originally. Brendan Morrow, who is the current artist on the game, he was playing the game and he was telling me how he thought it was so cool that suddenly the ship broke and he couldn't close any doors because it really changed the strategy up and it made it really tense. And I was like, that was a bug. And then he had spent like 5 minutes explaining like how exciting this, when you have those player stories, and how he managed to get out of there. And I was like, well, maybe that should be a feature. And that one, I debate that one because it's a brutal one, right? Because when you can't close doors, like that's very important in this game. And I've had some really funny deaths when I've forgotten about that or I haven't paid attention. But so that's, I debate that one, whether or not we should leave that one in. Because that's a mean one.
Speaking about mean ones, we can probably talk a little bit about the enemy design, sort of how you came with the challenges of the game. So, Earlier in the cast, you mentioned that one of the big watershed moments for the development of Duskers was the addition of the command prompt, and essentially letting players control things via this old-school prompt-like interface, like something from like the late 70s, 80s type design. Let me rephrase that. This idea of controlling the drones in that kind of fashion, was that something you had from the beginning of development, or did that sort of come while you're in the early stages of designing Duskers?
That came from the early stage of design. Actually, that came really early in the design. I was actually, and this is a debatable story because everyone claims that I'm crazy, but I swear I was at TIG Jam, and this was the first time I had thought about Duskers in the back of my head, but I had never put anything, you know, down in code. And so I started creating Duskers over this long weekend at this, you know, game jam, essentially. And I was piloting these drones through, and I really liked the feel of it. And I swear Ian Stalker, who made a Scapegoat and Soulcaster, or Alex Austin of Gish and Sub Rosa fame, they were both sitting next to me, and I showed it to them. And I swear one of them said, "That's really cool. Like, why don't you, like, you know what would be crazy is if you put a command line interface in this." And like many great suggestions, I laugh at them at first. I'm always just like, "That's so stupid." And then I stop and I'm like, "Or is that just the best idea I've ever heard?" Right? And so neither one of them says they own up to other things, but both of them say that neither one of them said that to me. So maybe I was just crazy and it's all my fault, but I wanted to have them to blame. So I always said it was their idea. But it just, again, it just fit with the motif of the game because the game started to become more and more. At first, the game was not necessarily everybody was dead. At first, the game was a lot more this Han Solo thing where like you owed some people money. And so you were going to go essentially tomb raid to try to get enough money on this like get rich quick scheme so you could pay back some people. And then slowly as time went on, it just got darker and darker. But it really seemed to fit with this motif because actually what was happening is that originally you clicked on the doors to open and close them on the schematic. And maybe I'm weird, but I always hate going from my keyboard to reach over to that mouse. Right. I always want either I'm only using mouse and keyboard, kind of like what you do with a first person shooter, or you're all keyboard or all mouse. Like I'm not a big fan of like moving that hand, even though I move them to the arrow keys right now for Duskers. But that's like it's almost OK. So especially when you're on a laptop, you know, because the trackpad drives me crazy. And so like when he started saying that, I was like, this kind of is really funny because it went so many of the things about Duskers went against a traditional real-time strategy game. You don't drag select units. You don't even use a mouse. Like you can issue concurrent orders, but you can also go and individually control these units. They're not people normally. Like you want them to be people so that you can empathize with them. And if your squad mate dies, you feel really bad as opposed to like just a robot. And all of these were things that my designer friends were telling me. They were all like, this is, you know, these are all problems with the game. there's a reason RTSs do it this way. And so this was just another thing that was like, well, this game is different and this is why I want it to be different. And this fits in with the personality of this game. And so I was like, hey, you know what, let me try it. And as soon as I started it, I got the funniest feedback. Almost everyone I put in front of that game was like, I really love this command line interface. You should totally get rid of it.
And
because it was that classic, like, you know, I get it, but other people are not going to get it. And this is not a mass market kind of money making scheme.
Yeah. And definitely a battle command prompt really fitting goes back again to that central theme of adapting and how it really works within the framework of Duskers. Now, another. Yep.
Yeah. I think a little bit the command line to me is about that atmosphere, about that. And maybe this is getting a little bit too deep on our current society, but like there's this whole battle we have with technology, right? Where like, oh, Facebook enables me to see pictures that my mom posted this weekend. But then by the same token, it keeps me more separated from people, because instead of calling them up or going and eating with them, I'm like, oh, no, 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 I know what's going on in their life. So I think the command line is yet another one of these things where it's like, I have to speak to this computer in its language. Mm-hmm. Because it's not a human. And that's reminding me of that, and reminding me of that sense of isolation. And that kind of, I wouldn't call it clunky. I feel it somewhat fluid, but like in a way it's a barrier. It's a barrier to rapid and slick, you know, UIs and stuff like that. And it's creating that sense that like, this is a machine that you're communicating with. This isn't a person, like you're alone. And so I felt like on all sides, the command line kind of started to make sense when you're controlling these bots and you're isolated and all this stuff, and you're relying on this gritty old tech, and it just sort of fits snugly in there. And that was the reason why we did it. And I really didn't think anybody would ever give me money to make a game like that. I joke that, like, because a lot of people watched, I made these puppet videos about pitching to publishers. And a lot of people joke around about that. And so I always say that, like, and this was honestly, as juvenile as I am, I almost did this on purpose so that if I ever had a pitch to publishers again, I would have to bring this game into them and say, this has a command line interface, watch their jaws drop, and then have them kick me out of the building.
Awesome. All right. I want to try to keep things moving along, because I know we said we're only going to do an hour, and we're probably going to be going way over that at talking about Duskers, because it is very interesting design. As you said, it really stands out with the command prompt and this sense of adapting. I like what you said a few minutes ago regarding changing the story from being this Han Solo mercenary type thing to this more you are alone, there is no one else out there to help you type situation. Again, it really just lends this really, this claustrophobic almost sense to Duskers.
Yeah, the drone view, I don't know if you've ever noticed, but the camera is just a little too close in that view. And at the beginning, people would always be like, they would want to zoom back. Mm-hmm. And I did that on purpose, and that was the claustrophobia. I wanted you to not be able to see everything out there in the darkness, and the camera to just be a little bit too tight, you know, so that you felt trapped and you felt like you didn't know what was around you. You know, there's a fine line between like annoying the player and creating this interesting sense of immersion. And we play with that a lot. The same thing when you're switching back and forth between the views, it's very clunky. It's not, you know, this nice scroll wheel that you go zoom in and out like a traditional RTS. And the isolation, that also came from a sense of realism. Like I wanted this game. I don't have a scene at the beginning where you see yourself sit down in this chair, because I wanted you to be the Dusker. This screen that you're looking at is your screen. That's your monitor, and you're typing on your keyboard. You're in this game. And so I didn't want to see your hands. I also didn't want to, you know, have, like, we decided not to do music. And a lot of these decisions were not only made out of that sense of isolation and being congruous with all these things, but like also this sense of realism that I kind of, this gritty sense of realism. And that was the thing is that, like, if you owe these people money, you have to interface with these people, and there's going to be a text bubble that comes up on the screen. And I felt like that takes me out of the world, because now I'm playing a game where if I order a unit, like if I mouse select a unit and I right click and he moves, people don't do that. Right. But in a game world, they do. So now all of a sudden I'm creating this layer, and that's fine. Sometimes when I'm playing a game like FTL or whatever, like an RTS, like I can, you know, imagine that world and it becomes real to me. But I just didn't want to have those layers to compete with. So I was like, that was a big reason that they were drones, is that I wanted it to feel real. I wanted it to be like, crap, like, here's this crappy camera that's showing me this computer vision. And the reason it moves when I tell it to move is because it is a robot.
There is no personality. There is no layer. So no layer to, like, its control. I can't automatically set it to patrol. I have to give it all these orders. It all comes from me or from the player.
Yes.
And again, it all really gives Duskers this very unique feel to it compared to other games, other strategy or roguelike games. Now, Another part of the drone operation is obviously the modules, and this is the major form of gameplay in the title, because these are basically all your command verbs that you can really tell your drone to do, whether it's shield, starting up the Gatling gun, or of course, what's become a favorite, the good old-fashioned cloak or stealth to hide around and try to avoid all the enemies. As you were coming up with the design for Duskers, how did you approach, like, the modules, or what kind of tools you wanted to give the player?
Right, well, so the modules, originally you couldn't hot swap modules in the middle of a mission. And then, again, the game is about adapting, and I figured that, you know, being able to swap those around would be really important. I also, and people may or may not like this, but I am a New England Patriots fan because I am from Boston. And believe it or not, they sucked for a very long time. But Bill Belichick, he was always very interesting to me because of the way that he created a team in an era where I felt like you paid, go with me on this analogy here, you pay a lot of players a very high salary, and those are your great players. And I felt like what Belichick had done was, he, instead of having A and C players, he had all B players that were like sort of interchangeable parts, so that if somebody got injured, you know, someone could sub in. And I always thought that that, and not only that, but they would game plan around, not only around a team for that week, but then, you know, within that game, they would completely change things. And so I always, you know, watching football a lot over the last decade or so, that's been really interesting to watch. And so I was always really excited about, like, having to think on my feet and having to change to the situation. And so the modules, as you were saying, is basically my way of doing that, is my way of saying, hey, the impetus isn't, like, this guy is really good at firing a sniper rifle and this guy is really good at being a tank. It was my way of saying, here's a sniper rifle and here's a rocket launcher. And, you know, maybe you want to put both of them on one person. Maybe you want to put, you know, distribute them around so that you, if one of them goes down, you still have the other weapons, and then they can pick that weapon off the other person. And so that's where that kind of came from. I do think that now we're going to make it so that the drones aren't completely interchangeable. The modules will still be the upgrades, but they will maybe have certain things about them to give them a unique flavor. But that will probably be secondary, like a nice to have kind of passive ability in addition to being able to do all of those things.
So in terms of the modules that are in the game now, are there any more, or do you have any ideas for future modules that you'll think you'll add in? Or is everything in the game sort of going to be it from this point on?
So we're definitely going to add a lot of modifications, which are basically how you tweak those modules. For example, we just added one for the shield where it's a radiation shield now, so that you can go into radiated rooms and not die. And we just added one to the ship surveyor, which is a ship upgrade that allows you to see which rooms are prone to radiation leaks and stuff like that, to give you a heads up for that kind of stuff. So we've got a lot of those planned. Upgrades, I planned on adding more. I never intended to have, like, you know, 100. Just like I never intended to have, you know, 20 enemy types. I kind of like it when you have these common things that are really good and can be used in a variety of situations. So what we are trying to do, I do want to add more upgrades, though when people suggest upgrades to me, they feel like one-use kind of things. And so what I'm trying to do now is make it so that upgrades can be used in a variety of circumstances. Like, for example, right now the pry upgrade can pry open unpowered doors, which is really useful when you need it and really not useful when you don't. And so maybe someone suggested we be able to pry, if there's an installed ship upgrade, you can pry that out. And that seems like a really cool use for that. And so, you know, maybe we can come up with other uses for that. That, like, the more uses something has, the more exciting things can be where the systems start to interact.
Definitely.
And so that's where the modifications can come in too. For example, one thing that I definitely want to do is add a modification to things. Right now, by default, because of a bug, if you drop a lure or a sensor in a room and then you open up an airlock and to vent an enemy, those will stay in the room. And I want them to get sucked out. However, there's going to be a modification to make them magnetized so that, like, you can drop a sensor in the room and then still have the sensor in there even after you vented it, which is very useful so that then you can steer other things into that without having to go back into that room.
Interesting.
You know, little things like that that start to kind of, and then maybe we could think of other use cases where, you know, having something magnetic would help, or maybe now that interferes with some other upgrade you have or something like that. So trying to make things a little bit interact more, basically have the systems interact.
And that definitely sounds like a good way to go with the module design. Now, I just want to clarify, when you say modifications, you're referring to the screen where you can upgrade your modules, spend scrap to either repair them or give them new functionality, right? Okay.
Yes. And there's a really funny thing with the terminology there. I really should name the upgrades modules and then the modifications maybe upgrades, because everybody thinks that way. Originally, the upgrades were the modules and they were just upgrades, and there was only one tier. And then we started tweaking those and we started calling those mods on your upgrades. So I might have to change that terminology. All right.
Let me see. There's so much we can talk about with Duskers, but I know we're getting a little bit late, so I don't want to keep you hopefully for the rest of the night. So one part that I definitely want to touch on with Duskers is the enemy design. Right now, there are currently four enemies, I believe. One, two, yeah, four, if we count the goo, I guess. In terms of the enemy design, how did you approach creating enemies for the player to deal with?
They were kind of in sequence and by need. The first enemy, and I don't want to give away any spoilers or anything like that, but the first enemy was the swarm. And the whole reason behind the swarm was I wanted to, actually they evolved from a very different version of the game, but the swarm I just made very aggressive, and I wanted it to teach you that you can't open doors willy-nilly. I wanted it to be a really hard lesson, kind of like in Super Meat Boy or anything like that, where you just die and it's quick and it's painless, right? Or painful, but very fast, so that like you learn. I didn't want the game to sit there and encourage you, because most people, they open doors because that's how games work. It's a dungeon crawler. You open up the door, there's bad things inside, you shoot them or you hit them with your sword or whatever. And this game is very much not that. So I wanted to teach you that right away. However, over time, it quickly became apparent that that was a little bit too brutal. So that's when the brute got introduced, as I call him, which is a random name for him. That's the kind of jumper one. And the idea behind that was that it would jump at you and nail you and take away a lot of HP and teach you that lesson. But then it would kind of have this weird aneurysm thing that would give you enough time to GTFO, right? And then that wasn't that wasn't nice enough. Because like everybody who played the game, it was just so brutal. So then I made the patrol bot, who was like, I feel like the kind and gentle, like slap you on the wrist, like you came in a room and you shouldn't have done that because you should have like either scanned it or been clever. But here I'm just going to hit you with a couple little, you know, a little Nerf, you know, balls. And like you get back out of that room and shut the door and we'll pretend this never happened. Though I say that, and I'm kind of a sadist, so like it's really not that nice. A lot of people die. I've died a lot from the patrol bots, but they are a much kinder, gentler enemy that does allow you to make mistakes and then back out. So those were all kind of like me trying to nerf enemies. And they all, of course, have their own quirks about them where they behave differently and they detect you differently. And the slime was really my response to. I felt like the slime actually came before the patrol bot. The patrol bot was just like, fine. But the slime was kind of my response to. I felt like I had two enemy types that were very traditional, sort of, you know, moving, detectable things. And I wanted to create something a little bit different. And the slime was originally just going to grow as you explored the ship and cut off retreats, cut off passages, so that when you went back, you might have to have a different route, or you might have to redock the ship or something like that. And eventually, outposts were the answer to that problem. Like in an outpost, you don't have, we take away your exit eventually as we switch the transporter signals around. So that was sort of my solution to that. But the slime was still a solution, but it was also interesting because we allowed the slime, it grew so slowly. We allowed it to, you know, go through walls basically and like grow from a wall. And that was really dangerous because your generator would be sitting there just parked at this, you know, power inlet. And so we made it so that the sensor would detect slime, but the motion sensor would not because it moves so slowly. And ironically, the slime is sort of like my nemesis. Like, I die more of slime, I feel, because I underestimate it too. Like, you'll do that thing where you'll just be like, you know what? I know I can drive through this, but you underestimate like how much like your HP that drains on your drones. And then when you're going through and anything else happens, then all of a sudden you run into another enemy, you're really weakened and they just can just take you out so easily. I've also had the enemies work together on me, which is really pissing me off. I one time was driving through with my stealth and the slime had literally grown across the doorway where I couldn't see it at first because I was just driving through the hallway. And then I tripped on the slime and that made my stealth field go away because it, you know, it short circuits when you take damage. And there was also a swarm in that room. So then the swarm saw me immediately and then attacked me and chewed my face off. So it was almost like they set me up. Like one of them was going to trip me and the other one was going to hit me over the head.
Nice.
And it was like just collusion against me, my children, these things that I created, they worked in tandem to kill me.
As we've said, Tusslers is obviously in early access. Are you planning on adding in any more enemies? I guess, if spoiler alert here, but are there any more obstacles coming in future versions of the game?
So I don't have a specific enemy right now that I'm like, okay, this is definitely going in. But over the last week or so, I did have a really evil idea for one. Because a lot of times what I'm trying to do is make it that, like, there's no solution that works for every enemy. And currently there are a few that do in general. And so I was thinking about an enemy that might take not, you know, I mean, only one out of five in theory, you know, but make it so that even when you're trying these things, there's like a risk reward kind of thing. Like, I love that. It's kind of like how with the motion sensor, right? Like, you relied on that, and you're like, well, that says this room is safe, and then all of a sudden you're in slime, and you're like, okay, well, I get it. It's not that I opened the door and I died, but this room isn't necessarily completely safe, right? You can't do that false positive thing. You can't be like, oh, okay, this works. If something works 10% or 90% of the time, and 10% of the time you just die, it kills everything, which is how this game works, then you can't rely on that thing at all. So that's why, even though the slime isn't detected by it, it's not as aggressive a threat, and so I don't feel that anybody's going to lose four drones because they opened a door to a room with slime in it. But I do feel that, like, anytime there's a pervasive strategy that people aren't adapting because they're like, oh, I just rinse repeat, I want to take that away from players because I feel that people will tend toward those exploits just because they want to win, they want to get further, and it's kind of my job to not allow that to happen because it's a lot like people will complain, they'll use exploits and then, or they'll complain about the upgrades breaking, right? And then there'll be a bug in the code. There was one guy, there was a bug in the code and his upgrades weren't breaking. And all of a sudden he was like, oh wow, I really see why you break the upgrades because like I've just been amassing upgrades and the game isn't fun anymore because I can just use my favorite ones all the time. Yeah. So that would be, if I add in another enemy, it's never going to be because I feel that the game needs like six enemies or else like I can't put that as a bullet point on the, you know, on the Steam page or something like that. It's always going to be because I feel that it brings something else to the equation that forces you to think in a different way.
And as you just said with the module breaking, that's a really good example of something that you've been working with in terms of balancing out how difficult the game should be and how much rope you give the player with, as you've changed it so far. First, it was just a module didn't break, then they would break in different stages, and now, basically, every time you use a module, it raises the chance that it could break. And it definitely changes how the game is. I restarted with version 0.25. I'll probably do another restart with 0.26 to see how things are, and it's definitely a lot more challenging now to deal with the game because I know that everything that I'm going to use, there's a good chance I may not have it for subsequent derelicts to explore.
Right. And the idea behind that is exactly that. Like, if you find your favorite toy, you can use that for a while, but eventually you're going to have to adapt and use something else. And that was the whole point behind that. And I think people were getting frustrated because I've never made a roguelike before. Mm-hmm. And I forgot how long runs. People will be on these runs that are like, 5 to 10 hours. And so they get really mad if they perceive that they lost because of a random number generator. Now all the hardcore players are going to say you should never have been in that situation. However, it doesn't change the frustration from when something breaks that you need to work at that point. And so what we've tried to do is expose more information. So now you can see at what point it's likely to break. And like, we're giving you the odds. We're basically the blackjack dealer. And we're just saying, hey, man, you should double down right now. Or you know what? You should not hit on that 20.
Yeah.
Right. And if they do, then I hope that they'll probably still get mad, but I hope that they take ownership of that. And they're like, well, I pushed that. And right now, actually, we don't have it. We no longer have it so that the upgrades break mid-mission. I want to return to that because I thought that was exciting. I thought it was really fun when I pushed an upgrade and then all of a sudden it broke. Like, I armed my Gatling gun and then I'm wandering through the derelict and then my Gatling gun like breaks and I'm like, oh, wait a minute. That was covering my 6, and you have to respond. Again, this is adapting, but I understand, and we'll make that an option because people, right now the way that it works is totally fine. We wait till the end of the mission, and then in between missions is when those things will break. And so you will always know when you go down to the mission, at least, you can use that. But I want to add it back in that it can break in the middle of the mission because I always thought I missed that, and I'll just make it an option. And I'm fine with that now. I used to be more like, this is the way the game is meant to be played, and now we're adding in option after option after option on difficulty because there are different people of different skills, and I want people to be able to play the game in different ways. Like, some people love the tension of these events that happen in real time. Other people want to play it like almost like a turn-based game where it's like it's all about them thinking through the strategy. So I'm allowing them to turn off, some of the elements that are more real time because, if it's that or them walking away from the game, I'd rather them have fun with it. And hopefully after they get good enough at it, they'll turn those things back on and then they'll enjoy them, because the game can just be kind of hard on new players.
Especially when I restarted, when you're back to square one again, you're trying to find those models and get enough scrap to keep going. It can get very challenging to play and keep up, really, with how quickly things can escalate when you move from one sector to another.
Yeah. We've added that, too. So we've also added an option so that to make sure that the first galaxy that you spawn in, is of a certain level of difficulty so that it's not ever... I kind of enjoy, because I've played the game way too much... spawning in a system, the system you spawn in is never like crazy, crazy difficult, but sometimes it can be kind of mid-level. And like you're saying, when you're starting out, that's really hard because, you haven't gained your momentum yet. But I find that exciting for me because I never know what's going to happen. When I get those, I'm like, I can do this, right? And I kind of ratchet down and it forces me to like another level of play. And so I like that. So I wanted to leave that in the game, but we've made it so no matter what on your first run, that first... And this should have been in the game from the beginning. That first galaxy is easy. And then now there's an option in the menu under difficulty that says every time I start, it's going to be in an easy galaxy. And not only that, but we sprinkle in a few more easy galaxies. So so that
you can get your
you can
feet
do that.
Wet, basically, type.
Yeah, we and now we're making it so that you can make it so upgrades break. Like it takes longer for them to break or it takes shorter for them to break. And the same thing with scrap, like less scrap, more scrap. So, you could, I'm trying to get it in a way that I've been playing a lot of Civ 5 lately. And I love the way that I can kind of, they give me enough options that I can tweak them and I can change the way the game feels. And I don't know if we'll get there, but that's the idea is like, oh, what if I was playing and there was tons of scrap, but my upgrades were always breaking, right? So I have to just be dumping that scrap into my upgrades and I have to make sure that I explore every ship's room so I can get all that scrap or vice versa. There's just no scrap, right? And maybe my upgrades break less, but now I'm stuck with the upgrades that I have. I don't know. It's hard for me to gauge how they'll play out, but the more variables I can throw in that you can control, the more that players can come up with that.
All right. definitely a great conversation, Tim. And again, we could sit here and talk forever. But speaking about having these changes and giving the player more options, that's a great segue into probably my final question for this cast. And again, we could come with so many more to talk about. But the final point I want to touch on, especially for people listening to Duskers who have played the game, is something about the future, what you have in mind for future updates and even for the retail version. We've been talking a little bit, we've had like little bits and pieces about future ideas, but for my final topic for this cast, I want to just focus definitely more on the future. Because I think this will be a great way, because I also have a few questions or a few things I want to ask you about. Just about some of my nitpicks about the game or what I've run into after spending like 30, 40 hours playing it. So I think this will be a great way of tying it all together and wrapping up the cast with. Okay, so the first thing that I want to talk about, especially with future content, is the story missions. So what you have in mind as what the player will be doing, I guess a high-level goal. Right now you have these different objectives like the Grey Goo, Pandemic, and exploring the research outposts, but the story chains don't really go anywhere, at least not yet. As the game gets further in development, what will the player really be doing, I guess, beyond just adapting to the game?
Right. So the way that the game works, we didn't want to be too intrusive with the story elements, because I know that a lot of people love the game and they love just playing it. And I don't want to force cutscenes on them and force them to play in a way they don't want to play. So what we've done is we've made all the objectives in the story off to the side. I love them and I care a lot about them, but everyone won't. So it's like they're there for you. So if you are the type of person that's like, what is this blinking objective button? What?
Yeah.
You know, or like, what are all these logs that I'm finding? How do they fit into this world? Then there is a rabbit hole to travel down. And so that's the idea. And then the objectives right now, you're right. Like, they dead end fairly quickly. Though one of them's pretty tough and we haven't had too many people beat it because, I forgot that we had a scavenger hunt in there and it emails us when somebody beats it. And we've only had about like four or five nice. People that have done that. Even though people have put like, you know, 100 hours into the game. So clearly those people are either challenged by this or they don't even care and they're just playing the game. But yeah, so that's the idea is that we're going to have this storyline that kind of tries to explain what happened and kind of you unearth that. And how we do that, it's very tricky. It's very difficult, I feel, to try to tell a sort of a crafted fiction in a procedurally generated Definitely. Game, especially one like a roguelike. And that's why I tried to go very traditional with this roguelike. I studied a little bit of, and I talked to a lot of game developers about, and game players about roguelikes and what they love and hate. And we're definitely going a more traditional, and I don't mean traditional turn-based, we're going a more traditional, like, you die, you don't get to keep your stuff. you don't get to go to the shop and purchase something to start the next game with. We're the one thing where there is persistence is the story. And so the logs, you'll keep them, and the progress that you've made on the storyline, you'll keep. And so that is a really tricky thing to do. What we're doing, our compromise that we made, is this objective-based system where, you know, that gives people clear goals and clear, like, progress in the story, but none of them are like, go to
X,
point A and do this thing. It's like, find a research station, and those are procedurally generated, and they could be anywhere, right? Mm-hmm. And so, you know, it's not like, go here and do this. It's like, you know, try to, one of them, yeah, it's like, go commandeer a really old derelict and bring it to this research station. And where the old derelict is and how you commandeer that thing is that's your own story, right? Like, there's not like, okay, go here and hit the green button. So we're trying to make it that it's open, but then we still have this crafted story because, I mean, that, like, the player stories are amazing and that's what the game is about. But then I always love having narrative and I always love a well-told tale. And so that's kind of the atmosphere of the game is that, like, why did this stuff happen? And, you know, whether there will be a quote-unquote end, But I don't know if there'll only be one, and I don't know if that end will be definitive. So if I could be more vague, then I would, but I think that's pretty damn vague.
All right. And another part I want to touch on, as we said earlier with trying to get rid of your favorite toys or keeping the player adapting, one thing that I found, at least with when I get really far, is that the game can really become feast or famine. If I get lucky and get enough early scrap or enough early modules, things are just very, very easy. If I don't get that and I'm just forced to, you know, keep throwing away my modules that are breaking, I don't have enough scrap to repair it, the game is a lot harder. But again, when you reach that point of sustainability with enough scrap, it just becomes all very easy because you really just don't have to worry about it. I mean, why do I care if my module's breaking if I have, you know, 200 scrap in the bank that I can just repair everything with? So I was just wondering, in terms of, I guess, balancing out these two extremes of either having nothing at all or be overflowing, are there any plans on your end to, I guess, further, I guess, adjust the difficulty of the game?
So this is a tough one. This is one that I have to think on. The problem is that another thing, sometimes I have random little synapses that fire in my brain and they cause me to make decisions. So one of the decisions I had in this game, and it revolved around that through line of realism, was that the game wasn't you start in the easy system and you work your way through more difficult systems. The galaxy is the galaxy and the universe is the universe, and we randomly generate it, and there are hard areas and there are easy areas. And you stumble upon those when you stumble upon them, and you're given objectives. And yeah, sure, maybe one time the objective that you have is really hard because of where you started, or much easier. And that's kind of in line with that. Now, the problem with that, of course, is that this problem that you talk about where, like, you can have a very challenging run because you just didn't get enough momentum. And then you can have runs where you got a lot of momentum, and now all of a sudden there's this snowball effect. And it does bother me when I watch a Let's Play and somebody has, like, you know, 20 upgrades and tons of scrap. And I'm like, okay, this is not the way that the game is supposed to be. It's supposed to be, you know, oh God, how am I going to use these three that I have together to get through this ship? And you do. So that would be, in theory, that would be sort of, that might be mitigated by making it so that there is a path. And as you play longer, the game just gets harder. By the same token, that would rob you of some of the other excitement, which is, you know, starting in a more difficult area, which can be really exciting, or having like a lull, you know. And I mean, that's how FTL does it. Like, it progresses, right? Things get harder as you go right. And so because this game is based on exploration, it's really hard to just tell people to go right, because they can go wherever they want. It could be that each, you know, successive universe that you get to is harder. It just feels wrong to me. It just doesn't feel true to the game, I suppose. But there is this friction point that it's causing and that I have to resolve. And I either have to resolve it by coming up with a very clever solution, by just letting it be what it is, or by adjusting it and saying, well, the gameplay and the game design is king versus this weird synapse that's snapping in my head that says I want it this way because it fits with the game. So to be determined.
Yeah. And again, really good topic there about how hard you really want to make the game, because you can really go any angle really with how thusters can go. Especially, as I just said, with that feast or famine type thing. My best run was literally because I found Scan in one of the early ships. So that let me, that basically inferred the rest of the play. I was able to scan more ships, get bonus scrap, which then let me afford to keep my modules upgrade, which let them stay longer, and it just snowballed from there. But then in my latest game, I'm not finding Scan. I'm barely finding anything, and I'm really forced to survive, and it's very hard. I've lost a few drones already because I just didn't have enough ways to cover myself.
Right. And that might be a thing. Like, it might be that that might be another way that we can do it, because different ship types tend toward different things. And so it could be that a more even distribution of the ship types. I think it's kind of interesting sometimes when you're in a system and it's all, oh God, there's like all military vessels or something like that, and I don't have and interface, and usually those have defenses. And so, you know, I like that. I like the randomness of it, right? But when you get randomness, then you
of
get
course,
stuff like
yeah, you
that,
can never
right?
predict it.
Of course, we can also, we're also, keep in mind, we also haven't had thousands of players playing. So before we launched Early Access, you know, we had, I think, 50 people own the game. And of those, of course, a fraction are actually playing each build. And so now, you know, we have thousands of people. And so it's really quickly showing, you know, any kind of imbalances, which we expected. And so it could be, I was thinking about this the other day, like, I like the fact that the scanner reveals additional scrap. I think that's part of the power of it. But maybe it's that, and certain ships, that additional scrap, like right now, I know certain ships that have between, randomly between 2 and 8 additional scrap, which is a lot of scrap. So you could mitigate that factor by simply saying, okay, now it's between 2 and 4, or, you know, and so, you know, there are all these little levers and knobs that we can dial in when we hear stories like that. This is why I'm always asking for feedback and always asking for Let's Play, so I can see these things, because, you know, I can play the game 100 times, but I might not have, you know, gotten a scanner early. And not only that, but every time we update the game, you know, these things are all slightly definitely different. And like someone just told us that the radiation shield is overpowered because they flood the ship with radiation and then they go through and pick it dry. And so, you know, then I'm like, at first I'm like, well, maybe we could take that away. You know, maybe that was a bad maybe that was a bad modification. But then I'm like, well, wait, what if we made it that, like, maybe brutes and slime are immune to radiation? Like, now all of a sudden you can't just open up doors willy-nilly and use that exploit. And that might be like a better, that might be a more clever way of solving that problem rather than just, you know, the big axe.
Yeah, basically find, again, going back to find ways to adapt and changing things up from there.
Right.
All right. Yeah, this has definitely been a great conversation, Tim. My voice is starting to croak out on me as well because we've had such a great conversation. But I know it's getting late. And again, I would love to sit here and talk with you for the next 2-3 hours, but you got things to do. I gotta go rest my voice. So we're going to wrap things up with just a few quick logistics-related questions about Duskers, and then we'll say goodbye. The first one, obviously, is do you have a time frame for when Duskers will be done, or is that still too much up in the air?
It's a little bit up in the air. Originally, we said from our early access launch that we were going to do somewhere between 3 and 6 months. And I would still stick with that. And that's all based on, that's basically based on sales. Because, you know, we need to keep the lights on. And so we're getting close, we were getting close to the end of that. Now, we had a good volley of sales when we did the early access. So, the, no matter what, we're not going to be like tomorrow. But yeah, so somewhere in that time period, we want to make the best game that we can. And we've got so many great suggestions and I'd love to keep going. And but that'll depend on if we can generate enough interest when we do the updates. If all of a sudden a lot of people are coming on board, giving us more suggestions and, you know, filling the coffers with more development money, then, you know, we can keep going. And I would love to, because this is the kind of game that you could develop for forever. But as with anything, you know, we will have to cut it at some point. And that, yeah, that really kind of depends on how the next few months go.
And now, now with Duskers, are you planning on releasing it? Now, we talked about Steam. Is it going to be on any other distribution platforms?
So right now it is on the Humble Store and the Humble widget, which is on our website. But the rest is kind of to be determined. With some, I would like to put it out on as many marketplaces as I can so that people can get to it. But then each marketplace I add is just more effort for me to kind of maintain and sign agreements and so
all right. And now one last, I guess, bit of logistics. Is the game going to be available on like Mac, Linux, or will it just be PC only?
No, it's going to be on all three. The only reason, actually, so we have the build running on Mac and Linux. The only real reason that we didn't launch with support for that is because we are a tiny team, and I knew that there were going to be plenty of bugs and plenty of feedback, and we wanted to maintain that fast pace of iterating on the design. And we have to support 3 different operating systems and people's video cards and stuff like that. So I learned this kind of lesson a little bit on previous games where, like, it's sometimes if you add additional things, you look worse for it. Like, even though you did that additional thing, they don't see it as an additional thing. They see it as something to take a pot shot at. So I was like, if I launch this thing, even though I'll be like, hey, isn't it nice that I made the Linux and Mac versions available? That nobody would care. They would just care that, like, if it didn't work or there was a problem or whatever. And then we'd be sitting there worrying about graphics cards instead of like, oh, hey, what's the best thing for the, you know, to balance the game or whatever. So, yeah. So we're definitely, we have those up, and we actually have people playing them and giving us feedback. And so we're gathering, the community's being awesome, and they're giving us lots of bug reports on all that stuff. And then hopefully when we go into the beta, we've said that we will support Mac and Linux at that point. So like fully, like, hey, go out and buy it on the Steam store page because there's a little Mac icon. And at that point, yeah, then we'll be fully supporting it. Because no matter what, I mean, I've used Linux for a long time, and I wasn't going to make a command line interface that didn't support a Linux build.
Cool. All right. Before we say our goodbye, are there any other topics regarding Duskers that I didn't mention or you would like to bring up, Tim?
No. I mean, we went through – I mean, there's a bunch of stuff we could talk about. But I think we talked about some good stuff. Mm-hmm. I mean, I guess this is the point at which I'm supposed to say that you can go buy it on Steam or our website, duskersgame.com. I think that's it.
Do you have any final thoughts you'd like to say to the fans listening then to end the cast on?
Oh, definitely anyone – well, I mean, I'm sure that you have a wonderful community of listeners, but especially to those that have – gotten the game and been on our forums and supported us. It's been amazing. Like every time you guys post and you give us a bug or you give us a suggestion and then you add in that line at the top or the bottom that says like, oh, and by the way, like I'm having so much fun playing this game. It's amazing. And I've played it for 25 hours or whatever. Like every one of those puts wind in our sails and every one of those matters so much to us. So thank you for doing that, and thanks so much for all of the design support, too. Like, when I've asked questions and I've gotten feedback, everyone's been really respectful and stuff like that. So, I mean, it's pretty much been the best way I could have ever imagined a launch going for early access. And so I think we can kind of keep this ship steady. Then we could be one of the kind of examples of a community and developer working really well together to make the game better. And that's always my hope, and that's why I always try to launch my games early to the community if I can.
And I was going to ask you about, I saw there's other projects on the Misfits X site, but I assume that right now you are just completely focused on Duskers, right?
We are. We have a prototype for Chess the Gathering out there, and we had been playing around with The Last Shadow. And I had an intern sort of periodically working on Chess the Gathering a little bit, but it just kind of fell apart because I can't be a mentor because I'm so busy. And so at one point I was just like, all right, you know what? Like, we'll let people play the game. I've kept the server up so people can keep playing against each other. Mm-hmm. And we've gotten a lot of people excited about that. But yeah, like, we are just way too small to have more than one project going. So yeah, everything else is on the side burner except for Virus Named Tom Vita. That one is still front burner, but it's just sometimes the logistics of getting games on marketplaces are just entertaining.
All right. With that, we're going to wrap things up here. Again, Tim, it was a pleasure having you on. We had a fantastic chat. And again, I love it when these podcasts could go on for like 4 or 5 hours because it means that we're just really gelling and having a great discussion. But as I've said, I guess like 5 times already, hopefully I don't want to keep you all night long. So definitely don't be a stranger. I'd love to have you back on either for a regular cast, one of our, developer roundtables. And there's always the live stream we can do at some point.
No, absolutely. No, this is a blast. I'd love to come back.
So for those of you listening, we're going to wrap things up here for this episode of the Perceptive Podcast. As always, if you'd like to support Game Wisdom, we have several options available. If you'd like to submit a guest piece for the site or be a future podcast guest, you can find information and links under Submissions Wanted. To contribute to our ongoing Patreon campaign to secure some much-needed monthly funding, you can find me on Patreon under Josh Spicer or Game Wisdom, or click that lovely Patreon banner on the front page, and any donations would be greatly appreciated. And lastly, as we were just talking about, if you like to catch any of the live streams where I'll talk and play a variety of games, sometimes with guests as well, you can find me on Twitch nightly around 10 Eastern under GW Bicer, and those videos will be posted to the Game Wisdom YouTube channel, which you can now find on the front page. So, again, thanks a lot for tuning in. Have a great rest of the week, and we will talk to you again next time. Take care, everybody.